Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I am your host, Aparna Gopalan, and today I'm going to be talking to Professor Alpa Shah, one of the authors of Ground Down by Growth, Tribe, Caste, Class, and Inequality in 21st Century India, which came out with Pluto Press in 2017. Here is the interview. I'm delighted to be speaking with Professor Alpa Shah, the author of Ground Down by Growth. Welcome to the program, Alpa.
Thanks, Aparna. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me. I'd like to make a minor intervention in your introduction that I am just one of the authors of Ground Down by Growth, but we'll get to that in a bit.
Okay, yes. So co-author of Ground Down by Growth. Just to begin, in our correspondence recently, I learned the great news that your 2018 book, Night March, had been longlisted for the Orwell Prize. And that got me thinking that in some ways, the newest book, Night March, has circled back to some of your earliest work on tribal politics and insurgency in central India. So my question is, how did you come to become an anthropologist of South Asia with an interest in revolutionary uprisings? And how does Ground Down by Growth fit into this trajectory?
I think I've always been interested in inequality and various kinds of efforts to address it. And when I was a student at university, I was reading geography. And at that time, you know, like many people in England, you know, that the left was in very much in decline. And one of the ways in which you directed your efforts was to think about development, you know, international development as a way of trying to improve, you know, the unequal situation that you see all around us. You know, my upbringing was in Nairobi and in Kenya, and I think that had a deep impact on me in terms of the vast kind of inequalities that people lived in. And then when we came, my family moved to England, and I think, yeah, that these like deep rooted experiences and also my own family history and working on in agricultural fields in Gujarat, and then ending up, my father was a doctor and, you know, a kind of actually a success story like many other South Asian diaspora stories of success into future generations. And but thinking back to my own family history and thinking about the inequalities that surrounded me in Kenya, those kind of concerns were very much prevalent. And like, as I was saying, most people in my kind of generation, you know, the ways in which they tried to think about and work with inequality was through development. And, you know, I was naive. I thought, you know, international development efforts could, have an impact on poor people. And what I felt, I think, was that many of the policies and programs that were being conceived for people in faraway places were being designed in ivory towers and at university whilst reading geography, I realized that actually there was this thing called anthropology, because some of the best books I was reading were written by anthropologists. And this subject, anthropology, involved being deep immersion in societies that you kind of otherwise would not know, and challenging received wisdoms about conventional, about the world. And I was particularly influenced by certain books I read, for example, Jim Ferguson's, Anti-Politics Machine, where he questions the whole development machinery through the Tabaseka program in Lesotho, a Canadian-funded program. I was really influenced by Melissa Leach and James Fairhead's book, The Misreading the African Landscape, where they show these grand narratives of deforestation, if you look from a bottom-up perspective, through the people that were living, the lives of people that were living in those areas in West Africa that they studied. Actually, there was a reforestation process going on. I was really, influenced by Nancy Shepherd Hughes' Death Without Weeping. And so I realized that actually, I'm reading all these books, and then I realized there's a pattern. The ones that I'm most interested in, they're all written by anthropologists. And so I turned to anthropology, and I decided to do a master's in anthropology at LSE. I had been in Cambridge previously, and I just wanted to be in the big city. But the training I received as a master's student, it was very, highly, highly theoretical. And while that was all great at one level, I felt like I was nowhere closer to my goals. And actually, I needed to go to the field to actually just be involved in practical work, development work. I still thought at the time, and I thought, well, academia, gosh, yeah, it's such a, it's very interesting, but it's not for me. And so I thought, where shall I go? What shall I do? And because I had, as I said, these distant roots in India, I thought, yeah, I'll go to India. I was fascinated by India because of my own family history. And so I landed up in India, in Delhi, actually. And then I didn't want to go anywhere where I had any family connections, because I was very concerned that I'd be kind of, as a young woman, Indian woman, I would be it would curtail my movements, and I decided to stay as far away from Gujarat or that side of India, and I landed up in Jharkhand completely by chance. So many things happen to us by chance. Jharkhand is a state in eastern India, which at the time was part of Bihar, which was a part of Bihar that not many people had knew about, or the Lonely Planet had a very brief kind of account of it at least. And then I was working on various with an NGO at one point, and then with the Department for International Development Project, UK government project at one point, and I felt I was still very far from the reality of people's lives, because most of the time you were going around in these jeeps, in these Land Rovers through the landscape, and you lived in the cities in these hotels or kind of guest houses, and there was never any time to really immerse yourselves amongst the people and really get beyond a certain kind of very very superficial account of what was happening in these areas, which you were then supposed to be addressing through development efforts. So I then thought, well, actually, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I do kind of need to go back to academia and do a PhD in anthropology, because that will actually enable me to really think about inequality and efforts to address it from a very grassroots perspective. It will give me the opportunity to, stay for 1.5 years. By that time, I was already really fascinated by Jharkhand, and ended up staying there for 6 months. Before I started my PhD, so that's kind of how how I ended up becoming an anthropologist and South Asianist, just intrigue and default of choices or chance occasions and working in Jharkhand completely by chance. And then my initial PhD was all about, you know, a big UNICEF program that was coming into the rural areas of India. It was called the Development of Women and Children in Rural Areas Program. And I was interested in how these policies for gender and, you know, women and child development were being implemented on the ground. And then, of course, when I started living in, that was my proposal. And then when I started living in these villages in Jharkhand amongst the Adivasis, I realized that these things exist only on paper. The groups that were supposed to exist under this program, you know, there were meant to be 14 successful groups in this one particular block of 114 villages. And actually, you know, they really were only on paper. And so, you know, well, anthropology is just a whole, it's an amazing subject because it allows you to completely, you know, rethink everything that you started off with, including your entire proposal. And so I became, you know, much more interested in like what the state meant to people and what kinds of efforts were coming down from the state in the name of the people and how people at the grassroots understood them and their interactions with the state. And then a various range of different kinds of players that were trying to, you know, improve the conditions of Adivasis in Jharkhand, which was the state, but also various indigenous rights activists. And towards the end of my doctoral research, the Maoist Naxalite, you know, the Maoist-inspired Naxalites started moving in through into those villages, and some of my village friends were being recruited to join them. And I thought, yeah, they're just a bunch of, you know, racketeers, really. They're like the Sicilian mafia. And this was, you know, actually I wrote a paper about them, in those terms as a kind of another kind of market of, you know, entering these markets of protection. That's what the article was called. But then I came back to England and, you know, I watched things from afar and I got more and more intrigued by the fact that so many people were joining, the Maoists from you know, so many Adivasis were joining them. And so this was like, so in my initial stay in Jharkhand was in the 1990s. My PhD research was 2000, you know, to 2002, the fieldwork itself. And then I'm watching things in 2004, you know, they're considered the biggest internal security challenge. They're united. And then in 2006, they're considered the biggest single internal security threat by Manmohan Singh, the then prime minister. And meanwhile, I had become fascinated by them. And I was trying to get back to Jharkhand to actually go and live in one of their guerrilla strongholds to find out, you know, more about what's happening and, you know, why is it that, or what's happening. And I wasn't convinced by the stories that we could get here about why Adivasis were joining them or not, as the case might be. So this is just to kind of give you an idea of like how, you know, one thing leads to another, and then you question your own kind of assumptions about, you question the assumptions that people, the people that, you know, the, in my case, whether it was development practitioners or the state or the Maoists or the indigenous rights activists and various forms of activism on behalf of Adivasis to address inequality. So by doing such an in-depth work, you end up kind of questioning them, and you also end up questioning your own assumptions about what you had thought previously. So that's how things kind of developed. And as a result of this kind of long-term immersion in Jharkhand, you know, I lived there over 4.5 years, several things were striking. You know, one was that, you know, this was a period of economic growth. in India. You know, India was now set to be one of the world, you know, it is now the world's fastest growing major economy, you know, the IMF has said. India was transforming massively during the time that I was there. Even, you know, a place like Ranchi where I'd lived, you know, it changed dramatically from being a little sleepy, quiet, you know, town when I first got there, you know, hardly a rickshaw on the main street. And now you can't like move through the city because it's chock-a-block with, you know, all kinds of vehicles, from trucks to motorbikes to, you know, the bicycle. Forget, you can't even cycle there now, you know. I mean, or of course people do cycle there, but because they have to. But, you know, I mean, I stopped cycling in Ranchi city in 2008, because it was just too dangerous. And so it's just, and you know, there's this massive building, the infrastructure, huge towers coming up where there were mud huts. And so it's, you know, this huge transformation was taking place, you know, right before my eyes. And this was India's kind of economic growth. And of course, this was a place which was full of India's mineral resources. It had the greatest, you know, kind of wealth of iron ore reserves, you know, of coal, bauxite. Meanwhile, there are all these Adivasis who are living in, you know, in the villages where I worked, who in terms of poverty levels were, you know, extremely right at the bottom end of the whole spectrum, who, you know, lived in mud houses, had no electricity, there was no sanitation. You know, many of the villages I lived in, you know, there was like maybe 10% of the population was literate, even that only to a very small degree, you know. So it's just these, and meanwhile you have these, you know, this huge development taking place. And of course, then there was a, you know, the fight, you know, how the trying to get at those minerals, the kind of land laws that had been protecting Adivasis from their lands, they were being undermined. Meanwhile, the Naxalites were being, you know, cast as these terrorists, and security forces being brought into these areas, and human rights activists saying that this, the real reason for this was actually to get at the minerals underneath the land. So actually this is a process of a slow cleansing of the Adivasi population taking place under the economic boom. So that, you know, all these processes were going on, and inequality, economic growth was, you know, people were marveling at it, but inequality was rising. India now has, you know, $100 billionaires, but, you know, 60% of its population still lives below the poverty, you know, the international poverty line. These are the figures, but you can see this on a landscape, you know, of India, the rise of gated communities and slums, you know, that are at its doorsteps. And one of the things that really struck me about this is the importance of understanding these processes, and how we needed new analysis of the economy, that was a kind of bottom up analysis, because there are all these poverty figures being produced. I mean, people were not paying attention to, so the economists, of course, were producing all these figures on poverty, but very rarely did they pay attention to things like caste or tribe. And those that did showed us that, you know, Adivasis and Dalits across the country are 20%, you know, poorer than all other groups. That in terms of the jobs that they're employed in, you know, the worst off jobs, the casual labor jobs, you know, Adivasis and Dalits are more prevalent than other groups in them. So then you think about the analysis from the left. I mean, I happen to have, you know, spend a lot of time with the Naxalites. So, you know, their understanding of the economy is like it's, you know, semi-feudal and it's semi-colonial. And, you know, that was just seemed, you know, that was completely, in my opinion, is completely outdated. It's not the, you know, it needs complete rethinking, because capitalism is now prevalent across the countryside. So and then other sections of the left, you know, where caste and tribe didn't really figure in any of the analysis. So it felt like there was a need to, you know, bring together all of these different things that were going on: economic growth, poverty, the implications for poverty, where do Adivasis and Dalits feature in this? How do we think about, you know, the processes that underpinning underpinning the prevalence of Adivasis and Dalits amongst poverty figures? And also, you know, in the discipline of anthropology, like how at the time, you know, it felt very much that, you know, political economy, while there were people who were working on political economy, it was also kind of at the margins of the discipline. It would, you know, whereas once there were a lot, whereas once it was quite central, actually we needed to kind of reinvigorate, you know, new generations to take on the task of, you know, understanding things like inequality, economic growth, you know, and caste and tribe in relation to that. So, so that's how I kind of ended up thinking about, you know, Ground Down by Growth, or basically the research program that led to the making of that book. So it's a very long-winded answer.
No, I think it's actually, it was necessary, because it's also remarkable how if one just looks at, you know, your career trajectory, there's an argument there, because you see that you work on Naxalism and then you see that you work on poverty and growth. And that itself, you know, is a statement on the connectedness of these things, and not kind of divorcing, you know, the security problems from the problems of poverty, but kind of seeing it all in one frame. I think that that explains a lot. So thank you for that. About the book Ground Down by Growth, though, as you had started to mention in the very beginning, not only is the genesis of the book really interesting, but also the process by which it was researched and written is quite remarkable and unique, in that it doesn't take the form of an edited volume, but a co-authored collection in which all the scholars involved gathered together before writing the book. They thought about, you know, how to, as you describe it, thought about how to write the book together, how to do the research, and then in kind of a collaborative manner carried out the research and then, you know, came back and did the writing. So what was this process like, and what difference did it make that you wrote the book in this manner?
You know, I was really lucky because I was awarded an ESRC, that is the UK Government Economic and Social Research Council, and the grant and a European Research Council grant. Like, these were major grants to undertake this research. And what that enabled is to bring a team of people together to carry out work in different sites across the country. So what I think I felt was, like, I was having this one experience of Jharkhand, and I had these ideas of what was going on. And but, you know, like, as anthropologists, even though we try to, you know, we work on something so specific and such a localized studies we have, even though we, you know, make them multi-sited or we follow processes up the scale, at the end of the day, they're still about, you know, very focused on one site and following that site through different sites, if you see what I mean. So what I realized is that what's important to do in this case is to try and get a team of people working in different sites across the country to ask similar questions across all the sites, so we could have a better kind of nationwide idea of what's happening to Adivasis and Dalits. So the question that we started off with was, you know, how and why are Adivasis and Dalits, you know, at the bottom of the economic and social hierarchy? And this question emerged from the fact that we had this data that were from economists that showed, you know, patterns of Adivasi and Dalit impoverishment across the country in relation to other groups. And, but, you know, what economists are great at showing us is, like, patterns as appear in their data, but the processes, the bottom-up processes of what's keeping, the bottom-up processes, which can be followed up the scale, of course, which are keeping Adivasis and Dalits at the bottom of society. Like, what are those processes and how have those changed over time? And that, you know, was a question, was our question, was a question that we wanted to kind of figure out. And so, you know, because we know that some definitely there have been changes in the forms of discrimination, like it in villages where there are still many villages in India where, you know, caste discrimination is very prevalent. You know, you a Dalit still can't walk through a high caste area without taking, you know, his shoes or her shoes off, or can't get water from high caste wells. I mean, that all form of discrimination, the ritual impurity. And, you know, just recently we had this news about two Dalits being forced to eat their own excrement. And, you know, so that kind of ritual impurity, that's kind of shocking oppression still exists, but in many places, it has been watered down. You know, Dalits can in Bihar, where there was prevalent, very, very strong caste discrimination, now look, you know, a landlord in their eye, you know, and answer back, and so there have been changes. So we wanted to understand, you know, what's happening in this new economy, and so to answer this question, it seemed important to try and have several studies in different parts of the country. So I paired up with Jens Lerker, who was one of the co-investigators on these projects and who led the program of research with me. And we put out an ad for postdoctoral researchers to come and work with us. So we wanted people who were already experienced working with Adivasis and who had already done work with Adivasis or Dalits or issues of inequality and poverty in India, who, you know, spoke the local language, who were kind of trained, you know, anthropologists, trained field workers. And we put out an ad, like international advert to bring together a team of scholars. And from that, we had the team that wrote the book, that is the co-authors to the book, which is, Richard Axelby, who worked in Himachal Pradesh. I'll tell you a bit more about the field sites in a minute. Then Dalel Benbabali, who worked in Telangana, and Brendan Donegan, who worked in Tamil Nadu, and Jaisalan Raj, who worked in the Kerala and tea plantations, and Vikram Ditya Thakur, who worked on the Beals and the Narmada basin. So this was our team, and we were together, all of us, for 3 years. And how that worked out was, in the first like 6 months, we were in London, and we read together the work of scholars whose methodologies and whose theoretical perspectives we found inspirational in thinking about the issues we were working on. So people, and they came to our seminars. So, for example, Jan Brayman, for his, you know, landmark work on migrant laborers in India, which actually proved to be kind of very central to many of the issues in Ground Down by Growth. You know, Jonathan Parry's work on labor in Bilai, on basically looking at the differences between Nokri, formal sector jobs, and Kaam, informal sector jobs. We had Barbara Harris-White involved in the program. We had Anantel Tunde coming. We had some of the economists whose work we were using, like K.P. Kannan and Ravi Srivastava, who had been part of that whole NCUS data set, which showed that Adivasis and Dalits across the country were worse off than all other groups. It was a big data set on informal labor. They had this, you know, landmark report in 2007, which was actually kind of embargoed for a while. And so we had, you know, all of these different kinds of people who we worked with to develop our ideas and to learn from them, basically, about, you know, think these issues with them. And then we had a whole process of field work whereby a year of field work. And in that time, Richard, Dalal, Brendan, Jayasilan and Vikram were based in their field sites. And the idea was that we had several kind of methods, like several things that we were following across each field site. So collecting, you know, some basic kind of data on education, on livelihoods, on land, on, you know, labor, on in each of the sites caste wise, so we could compare, you know, what was happening in the field sites, and then, you know, basic issues that we were following through the through each site. So, you know, labor relations, land relations. So if there were, you know, big corporations in the area, you know, how that their history and how they'd and how that impacted on the villages in which surrounding them. So just, so we had a kind of core set of issues that we were looking at in each site. And we met up then throughout the process of field work. So we had pilot surveys that we kind of got together to discuss. And then Jens and I visited each of the field sites and spent several days with all the postdoctoral researchers who were working there, and then they visited one other postdoctoral researcher. So, and then of course organic relations between them also grew. So, which are all, you know, it was, which was really nice to see. So, for example, you know, Richard Axelby visited. There were migrant workers in the Kerala tree plantations who had come from Jharkhand. So Jayasil and Raj went to visit them back in their home villages in Jharkhand from the tea plantations in Kerala. And, you know, Richard Axelby joined him in that trip to Jharkhand. So, you know, these kinds of organic relations which developed between the researchers, which also has, you know, generated, lots of interesting insights, and which made, you know, so the advantage of doing it like this was that, you know, we had the collective effort is just so much more than the sum of the parts, if that makes any sense, you know. So it's, so we could now think of a kind of India-wide analysis of what's happening to Adivasi and Dalit labor. So for me it was you know, I learned so much about the rest of India, and I could put my own I could compare the situation, my experiences in Jharkhand, and have reflect on them in very different ways by thinking at a kind of national level in relation to different sites. And we saw patterns emerging that we wouldn't have spotted otherwise. For example, you know, the fact that in all of the field sites, in three of the field sites. So in all the field sites except for one, migrant labor, seasonal casual migrant labor was really, you know, important. And in three of the field sites, this labor was coming from, you know, from central and eastern India, so places like Jharkhand. And, you know, and this, we could see, you know, we found Jharkhandi laborers in Himachal, we found them in the Kerala tea plantations, you know, we found them in the Tamil Nadu chemical belt. And so, you know, you see these patterns that you might not have paid attention to them otherwise. You know, a bunch of migrant laborers hidden in a dormitory in a house in Tamil Nadu, you know, when you're actually looking at relations between Dalits and their landlords in that site, and suddenly, you know, you start paying attention to these migrant laborers because you see them popping up across all your sites, you know, and they're hidden away, of course, and you can't normally see them, and, you know, and it's easy to miss them even when you're living there for such a long time. So it's things like that that, you know, I think made it a kind of quite exceptional and very rewarding undertaking. It's quite counter, it's not the way in which anthropologists generally do things, you know, like myself. I mean, you know, you just generally consider yourself as a lone researcher going out to your lone field site and, you know, working it away at things by yourself, and also part of the beauty of anthropological research, which we didn't want to lose in this kind of way of organizing things, is also that, you know, you come across things that you wouldn't have, you that were never in your mind even, you know, that your inquiry is open-ended, you know, so you have an idea of what you're looking at, but then that idea just changes over time because of what happens in the field and the things that, you know, you follow your nose basically, and you're led by, you know, a lot by intuition, but also by the people you're living with, what happens in their lives. And if suddenly, you know, people start migrating to brick factories, as I found in my PhD field site, you know, then, you know, you suddenly start migrating with them, you know, it's like not that that was never your intention, you know, that, or if they're joining, you know, armed revolutionaries, you suddenly start following them. You know, you'd never even thought about armed revolutionaries when you first went in the field, it went to the field site. So, you know, that's the beauty of anthropological research, is that kind of open-endedness and what that might bring to you. And of course, by doing it this way, we had a set of things that we were looking at across sites. So it was quite, you know, we did know the things that we were going to try and compare across each site. So there was that kind of, it was more constructed, the nature of the field research. But at the same time, we wanted each field researcher, each postdoctoral researcher who was out for, you know, the year, sometimes a little bit more in those sites, to be able to, you know, do much more than that's in Ground Down by Growth, that actually to do the kind of more classic anthropological fieldwork and to follow issues that, you know, whatever they became interested in. So we still had that going on side by side as well. And, you know, I mean, I'm hoping, certainly some of them have produced articles on issues, you know, which are tied to Ground Down by Growth, but are also different. And of course, you know, over the years, I'm hoping we'll see monographs, you know, on each of these places as well. So, I think, you know, it was the other thing to say is that, you know, what you're able to say, it's just so much more powerful because you've got, you know, the evidence from all of these places. So not just one place. So it enables you to kind of scale up your arguments in a way that you know you can't otherwise. So
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think you began to touch upon some of the you know, conceptual and theoretical innovations of this book, in addition to the methodological ones, which basically concern providing us a new way to think about both capitalism and social difference. And the way you do that in the book is you propose that instead of withering away, differences like caste and tribe actually become more entrenched with the expansion of capitalism, which is might be a counterintuitive position to many who might see, you know, the growth of capitalism as something that moves India towards modernity and away from traditional things like caste. And so could you speak a bit more about how you overcome basically the two impasses which we see both in the scholarship on caste and tribe on the one hand and capitalism on the other hand, where the two somehow don't seem to fit together. So what were some of the kind of ways in which you saw that not only do, you know, social difference and capitalism fit together, but they actually work synergistically to, you know, produce inequality?
Yeah, I mean, before I talk about that, I mean, it's not just our work which is showing that. I think, you know, there are other people on the ground who have been looking at these kinds of issues, though they might not have spelt them out in the same way before us. And I see very much what we're doing as building upon the work of other scholars. So let's just to turn to your question. I mean, yeah, you're right. You know, I mean, both modernization theorists and also, you know, Marxists alike expected or talked about caste kind of withering away. But what we have found across our sites is that Dalits and Adivasis were worse off across every single site. Dalits and Adivasis were worse off than all other groups, as the economists had shown us. The way this was happening was through their incorporation as informal labor in the Indian economy. So, of course, also in terms of materially and also in terms of education levels, they were worse off. But you know, their everyday kind of ways in which they were reproducing their households was through the informal economy. Now we know that, you know, of the astonishing figures that 93% of India's workforce works in the informal economy. So they don't have formal jobs, you know, so they don't have jobs with contracts, with security, with pensions, with they have none of these things. They have no health insurance. They are, you know, hired at a moment's hired on, you know, like often by contractors, and fired, you know, at a moment's notice. And these are people working in the absolute kind of pit of the labor hierarchy who, you know, building the Indian economic boom. And what we found across our sites is that the worst work was being done by Dalits and Adivasis in all our sites, you know. So they, and even where they had, you know, education levels which were the same as those of higher caste groups, they still didn't get the same. They still got worse jobs than the higher caste groups. So. You know, then the modern like kind of economy was kind of using, you know, exploiting the labor force of Dalits and Adivasis, and more so than that of, you know, other groups. And so things like the social caste and tribe, I mean, they weren't like they mattered in the new economy, and they were being used actually in the modern economy in all kinds of ways. So also by pitting, you know, castes against each other, pitting groups against each other to break their labor power, you know, is a kind of classic means of control. So let me give you some like concrete, you know, examples. So for example, in Tamil Nadu, where Brendan Donegan worked. So this was historically an area where there were big landlords, and in the village where he worked, it was like there were Nadars who were controlling the land, and there were Dalits who were originally, you know, bonded laborers, but then, you know, were the agricultural laborers, worked on the fields of the Nadars. Now this area became, with the economic liberalization, it became the site of a huge chemical industrial belt. So going all the way down the coast, this chemical industries were planted on the land. So in this village where he worked, on the fringes of that, there was an export-oriented factory making gelatine, you know, gelatine from cow bones, that was placed right there on the fringe of the village. You know, it's like a kind of Japanese venture. And so what happened as land became less important to the Nadars basically made sure that they took over the running of these factories. So they, you know, they got the best jobs. In fact, the factory itself was being run by one of the family or relative of the Nadars, and then the Dalits were being brought into the factory as daily wage laborers, so no formal contracts, and they were being brought to do hard, difficult work of working to clean those bones with very, very toxic chemicals. So, you know, they were doing the worst work in those factories. So from what you see in this case is that capitalism, you know, the development of this huge industrial belt, what it did is from an agrarian, from these kind of old landlord agricultural labor relations, we now have the development of industrial relations whereby actually the old landlords are dominating in a very different way in the factories over the Dalits, who are now, they control the entire kind of labor process and the kinds of jobs that Dalits can get. So, and you know, we have a similar process happening in Telangana, where there was a paper factory where the Kammas, who were historically owned the land, they still own most of the land in the areas, the Kammas and the Reddys, these are high caste groups, you know, they controlled the process of the labor in those factories. So the Adivasis and the, you know, Adivasis didn't actually want jobs in those factories, but a few did. But and Dalits were employed in these factories to do all the casual labor jobs, the worst jobs where they'd had no formal contracts. So so you see the ways in which, you know, in the new economies, it's actually what you see at the bottom end is Dalits and Adivasis are very, very, very prevalent in all of these sites. So that's how, you know, you see the importance of caste in the new economies, caste and tribe distinctions in the new economies. And what you also see is how, you know, castes are being used against each other. So for example, in Tamil Nadu, when the Dalit laborers decided to strike against their conditions of work, what the factory owners started to do is to bring in labor, Adivasi and Dalit labor from Bihar, Jharkhand, Orissa, to cut the labor power of the Dalits, you know. So they brought in, you know, a different group of people regionally and also at the bottom end of the scale regionally and in terms of, you know, identity. And they were put in place instead of the Dalits. So the Dalits, you know, they could just control the Dalits then. And so, labor being pitted against each other, low caste labor being pitted against each other, in the way in which, you know, capitalism kind of uses identities of caste and tribe in order to, you know, exploit labor further. So that's what, you know, that's one of the kind of, you know, key dynamics we saw taking place. And same in the tea plantations of Kerala, where historically it was Dalits who were brought to from Tamil Nadu to pluck the tea in Kerala by the colonial tea planters. And over the years, you know, they won some modicum of rights as plantation labor. But now with the collapse of the tea economy in the 80s and then the 90s and with liberalization, those plantations were taken over by various multinational corporations and national corporations, and they decided to, you know, as part of that process, cut the labor force, and Dalit workers who previously had permanent jobs were made into kind of more temporary status. And then when they decided, you know, to rise against their terms and conditions of work, you may remember in 2016 there was this famous women's autonomous kind of workers' strike where, you know, 12,000 women basically stopped working for a month protesting against their conditions. Well, you know, what was happening there was the plantation owners had already started. They had been bringing in, and they're now bringing in Adivasi laborers, in this case, the place where we were, where Jaisal and Raj was, and the pair made Tilbep tea belt. And in Munnar, you know, they started in bringing in Adivasi Santali labor from Jharkhand. And these laborers were not given even the temporary work status that Dalit workers had. They were completely casual. They were brought in only for 8 months of the year. And, you know, they'd go back and then they may come back the next year, or they'd be taken somewhere completely different. So again, you know, Adivasi is being pitted against Dalits at the bottom of the labor hierarchy to break the labor power of, you know, the Dalit workforce in this case. So, so these are just some examples of trying to show, you know, what it is that was going on, which made us come to this conclusion that actually the expansion of capitalism under this form of economic growth has really is entrenching rather than, you know, reducing these differences of caste and tribe inequalities.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for those examples.
Yeah. So yeah, I know, I mean, a lot of the scholarship on inequality has looked at economic inequality, but what we're trying to show is, you know, how social inequality is a part of that process of economic inequality as well. Yeah.
Mm. And in the book, you actually say that you call this this interlinked nature of social and economic inequality, you call it conjugated oppressions. So I'm wondering, how does the concept of conjugated oppressions politically play out, or what kinds of movements become possible when that's the way in which you conceive of inequality, rather than, say, as a separated social and economic inequalities, or as intersectional inequalities? So what are the political projects which flow from understanding the Indian landscape as one of conjugated oppressions?
Yeah, so let me just explain where that term comes from for us and why we use it before answering your question. So, I mean, we owe a debt to Filippo Gua, who worked, you know, on the banana plantations spanning the border of Costa Rica and Panama, and the use of different ethnic groups in those banana plantations. And he basically talks about, you know, conjugated oppression as being, you know, how he says it's how an ideological dynamic of kind of ethnic discrimination interacts explosively with a kind of economic dynamic of class exploitation to produce, you know, an overwhelming experience of oppression that is really more than the sum of the parts. So what he was trying to do in this, you know, looking at the exploitation of these ethnic groups on those banana plantations, was to try and show how, you know, this ethnic discrimination was inextricably linked to class relations, you know, that is, people's relations to each other as they are shaped by, you know, their relationship to the means of production and by their social reproduction, you know. So this was you could not actually separate the way in which ethnic discrimination was a part of class exploitation, you know. So that, to us, like, you know, really rang through in what was happening in these areas. And, you know, so we were trying to figure out, like, you know, intersectionality has kind of gained a lot of purchase in recent years. And while there's a broad brush of scholarship, you know, there's a very broad spectrum of people, you know, who are working on intersectionality, and they do it in different ways. And I think some of the work is like kind of close to what we're trying to do. But the mass of it is looking at how different categories, so for example, whether it's caste or gender, or, you know, race or gender or class, you know, how these, they treat them as independent variables, and they look at how they, as categories, they may or may not interact in a particular moment in time, and class itself is treated as a category. And for us, I think that was a kind of very limiting way of looking at what was going on. And what conjugated oppression allowed is to, you know, to show how these processes of ethnic oppression, of caste oppression, tribe oppression are inextricably linked to class exploitation, you know. So that, and we expand, you know, Philippe Bourgois's ideas to also look at region and gender as being central to the ways in which the oppression takes place. That's kind of brief explanation of conjugated oppression. And, you know, why it matters, I think it matters for struggles, because what we tend to find in many places, and of course there are exceptions, is that the people who are dealing with class struggles, like the Naxalites I worked with, for example, I lived with, or the, you know, many of the kind of mainstream, like, left parties in India, even the trade unions, you know, they basically are looking, you know, they treat class, they're looking at class, you know, they're not thinking about caste or tribe or, you know, gender, for example. So it's a big kind of weakness in left politics and left movements in India generally. I mean, this is not, you know, as I said, there are exceptions. But on the other hand, you know, there's a lot of Dalit and Adivasi politics, which has become about, you know, identity politics, and which may have or may have concerns of, you know, class exploitation. Some of it definitely does, but a kind of focus on identity politics becomes overwhelming, and there's this kind of impasse in a way, because, you know, you get the critique of the left from the Dalits and the Adivasis, and then the Dalits and the Adivasis kind of forming their own movements, which, you know, are wary of the left and which can easily turn into identitarian movements. And so I think that what we're trying to do is to think about how these things could come together in a kind of progressive politics. And there's a long history in India of these problems. It's almost like, you know, there's a fear amongst left scholars. Raj Chandravakar once said, you know, you treat the differences between workers seriously, like their ethnic differences seriously, and then there's this problem of, okay, well, where's the class? You know, they can't unite. You know, we can't point to these divisions because you can't unite. You know, that's going to challenge the idea of a class consciousness. And I think that's still kind of prevalent, in especially, you know, amongst the unions, and certainly, you know, the Naxalites have tried to treat caste more seriously. Tribe, I think they haven't, you know, even though their strongholds have been in tribal areas, they could have given much more thought to what it means to be in an Adivasi area. So this is like trying to, I guess, provide some kind of framework to really show that these things need to and have to be thought about together, and any kind of segregation is a segregation that is emerging from the very process of capitalism that is, you know, that needs to be challenged.
Thank you for explaining that and explaining the kind of afterlives and the political implications of the book. I know we've spoken a bit in our correspondence about how there's various ways in which you've tried to make the message of Ground Down by Growth available to a larger audience. And we also spoke about Night March, your new book. So in addition to those projects, what's on the docket for you now? What are you working on?
Well, I mean, one of the things I'm working on right now, very, very, very right now, is developing some of the ideas in relation to migration that are in the book. And, you know, so one of the, you know, the book highlights that there are three different important processes that are taking place in the ways in which capitalism and caste and tribe are interacting. One is these inherited inequalities of power, like the Khammas or the Reddys, or taking over, you know, the best jobs in the new economy and controlling what Adivasis and Dalits are able to do. And that, you know, we talked about the conjugated oppression ideal, but also what is central in that process is how migrant labor is super exploited in India, seasonal casual labor migration, and how Adivasis and Dalits are, you know, at the core of that, and they're everywhere. They are, you find Adivasis and Dalits in that labor force. And how, so one of the things I'm trying to think through is some of the feminist theory on social reproduction and the ways in which this labor is super exploited, which means thinking about not only what's happening at the site of production, you know, so at the site where the migrants go, so their conditions of work and their living conditions in their workplace, but thinking about how the entire, like, family, kinship, and generational you know, family and kinship structures of that whole migrant household, which is back at home, plus all their assets, the land that they may have and whatever little assets they have, is crucial to that ability of that laborer to be in working at that moment in time. So, you know, how the kind of whole economies of care of that migrant laborer, which go over generations and are, you know, very and gender relations are crucial to how we think about what's happening to migrant labor and the ways in which it's super exploited, and also what it means to think about politics for a progressive politics that includes migrant laborers. I mean, what would be that politics for migrant laborers are, you know, very rarely represented in any kind of progressive politics, notoriously difficult to mobilize. And so this is about thinking about, you know, the entire economies of care which enable migrant laborers to work. And so that's what I'm working on right now. But the other things are very much, as you said, we've been very keen for this the work that we're doing not to be just relegated to the ivory towers of the university. So we organized a major exhibition. We curated a major exhibition around these issues, which was shown at SOAS, and right now it's showing in Turin, at the ILO in Turin and in the university, and is going to move to the regional town hall. So I'm just about to go off tomorrow to Turin to participate in some of the activities around that. So it's helping, you know, these ideas to spread beyond the university and for other people to take on. We had an Adivasi fellow program where Adivasi's fellows, you know, young junior career fellows came to spend some time at SOAS and LSE. We've been working with unions in India to disseminate some of our research and discuss it and think about the implications for their work. So we had a meeting in Delhi in December when unions from, you know, all over the country came. And we're also working with the ILO to think about how, you know, in their decent work agenda, things like caste or ethnic discrimination could be much more centrally thought about, not just in terms of, you know, okay, the rag pickers or the rubbish collectors, but also just more generally in terms of work. And I'm also thinking a lot about the question of why we write, and why I write my other book, which you were kind enough to mention at the beginning, Night March, is written in a very different style to Ground Down by Growth. It's written for wider audience without trying to dumb down the scholarship. And I was really, I was delighted to be shortlisted or longlisted for this prize, which, you know, because Orwell was a really big inspiration. And in writing about it. So I'm thinking about that question of why I write more generally and in terms of anthropology and in terms of what it means to be a British scholar working on South Asia at this moment in time, and why we write and why we write in the way we do. And I'm still working through some of the material, both from Ground Down by Growth and also from my book Night March right now. And eventually, I'm sure that's all going to lead to other steps in different directions, which I think are too early to tell right now.
Well, I for one would like to say I really appreciate, you know, the thought you put to the political stakes of what you're writing, and even asking this question, you know, why should I write? I think more of us should be doing that, especially given, you know, the really horrible situation that most of the people in the world are living in. So thank you so much for writing this amazing book and for all your work. And thanks for being on the show.
You're very kind. Thank you so much, Aparna, for giving me an opportunity to talk about some of our work.